You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, everyone. This is David Tatasciore, lead engineer and studio manager of the Heritage Radio Network, and I'm reaching out to ask for your support during our end-of-year fund drive. A contribution in any amount supports our weekly programming and our mission to make the world a more equitable, sustainable, and delicious place. Plus, you'll receive exclusive member benefits like monthly playlists, discounted event tickets, party invitations, and more. So, if you like good food and you love good food radio, throw a little dough our way. Make your gift at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Happy holidays from all of us here at Heritage Radio Network.
Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, it's December 2016, December 13th. Our show tonight, we're going to talk about when did rarity start to equal greatness in beer. Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 in the Good Beer Seal. We've got some special guests joining us tonight. This whole show kind of started with our friend Aaron Goldfarb. He wrote for Punch an article called When Did Rarity Start to Equal Greatness in Beer? Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
And we do read, you know, we like to read. Every once in a while we get a book author on, but we haven't too often had a show based around an article. And Chris Bala, welcome to the show, buddy.
Well, thanks, Jimmy.
And what did you think about this article? I know it made you have a lot to say about it today.
Oh, I mean, I thought it was a lot of points well said and rarely spoken in our community about the nature of beer as, you know, a commodity and how it's consumed and how it's collected and, you know, kind of the general idea of, you know, the changes of beer as far as just a beverage to enjoy with your friends or, you know, have a longstanding social tradition to something that's more of a collectible and a rarity, which is, I feel like, very unique to beer as an industry.
Yeah, we have a lot to say today. Greg Dorosky from Threes Brewing. Nice to see you, buddy.
Nice to see you, Jimmy.
Haven't had you on for a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's been a while.
We're going to have a lot to talk about tonight.
And hopefully.
Our new buddy from beermenus.com, where you can keep up with
finding great beer.
The top beers are in New York City.
Everywhere.
In the world, right?
International.
What's your name, man?
My name is Gage. Gage Siegel. I'm here subbing in for Will, our founder.
All right. And got a Hillary Faison, our friend from NYU Food Studies grad program. Hey, Hillary.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for coming on. So, hey, big shout out to our sponsor, Union Beer Distributors, a supplier of world-class ales and lagers. All right. So, let's go. So, Aaron, just tell us about this article. It kind of like, I read it on Facebook, and I thought, wow, this is interesting. So give us a little summary of the article, people that haven't read it.
Cool. Well, so like most writers can attest, we spend most of our time dicking around on the internet and not writing, just reading. And one website I like is called the Wayback Machine, where you can look at old websites, what they looked at. You can see what CNN looked like on 9/11 or what ESPN looked like the last time the Yankees won a World Series. And I got the idea to see what Beer Advocate top 100 lists look like for the past 15 years. And there's hundreds of lists from starting in 2001 up to today. And I've been drinking craft beer since the early 2000s. So kind of along with my memories of how the beer industry was changing and what beers I was chasing and enjoying of the time, I matched it with the top 100s at the time to crystallize my thinking and see what was actually true.
That's cool. And Chris, I know you had something to say about this article. You said your friends say this is what you're talking about all the time.
Well, I mean, I felt a lot of similarities in thought with what Aaron kind of put out in the article, and I've been drinking craft beer for about the same amount of time. And I guess as somebody who, you know, buys beer for, you know, bars and restaurants, it's very much on my mind how it's presented. And, you know, I have a kind of a good connection on the drinking public from, you know, kind of the more beer, the beer nerds that are seeking out the white whales or whatever, to folks who are just coming in to drink something that's tasty. But yeah, it, you know, really kind of struck something in me about, you know, how beer is consumed today. And if people are actually drinking beer for, you know, the pleasure of drinking beer with your friends, or, you know, drinking beer so they could scratch another one off the list. And I think that's become more and more prevalent lately. But yeah, I thought it was very thought provoking. Well said.
So let's go back to 2001. In 2001, what were some of the top rated beers on that list?
In 2001, the number one rated beer in the world, according to Beer Advocate's users, was Victory Storm King Stout, which I think probably anyone who drinks beer has had at least once, but maybe not in a decade. Just a standard, pretty roasty and hoppy, if I recall, stout from the era, not barrel aged, not rare. It was just a beer. It was good. It's probably still good. I haven't had it in a while.
And then there were some other ones. A Duvel you mentioned?
Yeah, a lot of, you know, kind of the iconic Belgian beers of the era. Duvel was number four. That just so happened to be my favorite beer of the era when I was a, you know, 22-year-old looking for some bang for my buck. I drank a lot of Duvel at Market down in the Meatpacking District. Omegang Hennepin was big back then. Chimay was big. Oddly enough, a lot of Rogue beers were on the top 100, which would get you laughed out of the room if you brought a Rogue beer to a a bottle share these days.
It was everything that Michael Jackson was reviewing at the time, though, right? I feel like it's all out of Michael Jackson's writings from the late 90s.
Maybe. I mean, that's something you could perhaps match up. A lot of Dogfish Head beers start appearing in the early 2000s, too. At least six were on the top 100 in, like, 2003, I think. So you might be right about that.
It was like a lot of the pioneers of craft, too, like Victory, that are now, you know, bigger.
Yeah, growing. I mean, to be fair, there weren't as many breweries back then. We hit 5,000 breweries yesterday, and I think there were probably 1,500 back then, maybe less. Certainly probably under 100 that had a nationwide reach. So it was a lot harder for an obscure brewery to make the list. They're obviously was an Ironheart canning making it easy for, you know,
tall boys,
nano breweries to can tall boys and then geeks to trade them across the country. So only beers that were making supermarkets were probably going to be making the list back.
And trust me, listeners, this is a serious panel today. Greg, what, you know, if Duvel was Aaron's beer of 2001, is there another like old classic that you would have picked as a top beer?
I think, you know, when I posted the article, you know, I read the article and it definitely struck a chord with me. Kind of reflecting on my personal beer journey, I would say Orval is probably that beer for me. Saison DuPont is right up there. I think what was really great with Aaron's article, though, is beyond kind of just the information he was pointing out about how kind of the market has shifted and, you know, these particular beers, was this kind of second layer of analysis, which is kind of more almost social history and the evolution of beer, you know, as Chris mentioned, as this kind of commodity that's traded and hoarded and, you know, people wait in lines for it. And it really kind of gets at some of the discussion going on, at least on the brewing side, about what, you know, the function of beer is and, you know, what, you know, why do we all drink this? Why do we all buy it? Why do we all devote so much time to it? And it's a discussion that's very interesting.
And now, you know, now we all know we have Rate Beer, Beer Advocate, Untapped. There's places we can see the top-rated beers. But, Gage, you're here from beermenus.com. How do you guys track? How do you track your top beers?
Yeah, so the top beers for us are going to be twofold. We use search data because we've been around for 8 years, just a little bit less time than Beer Advocate and a little bit longer than most other beer sites. So when people are searching for specific beers, we end up being a top result. And so that people who view individual beer pages as a proxy for search data. So right now, we're coming off the heels of Bourbon County coming out. So thousands of people in the New York area, or pick a city, are searching for that beer. That's one metric.
Founders.
Founders, yeah. And I mean, when KBS is going to come out, forget it. But the other metric that's changes less is follower data. So people who want to be alerted as soon as a beer crops up. And I've got it sitting next to me here. And it's a lot of grim in New York City, in case nobody could guess. But it also ends up being surprising. A lot of people are following beers that we don't get here. Sip of Sunshine, Focal Banger, which, well, we only just got, so maybe the death of the tall boy. But Pliny the Younger and Elder as well end up being some top followed beers that have never been in New York City. So it's the hype that's around them that's sitting in the top 20, the top 250. People are still following.
Let's jump to hype, and you know, before we get too into that article. So I walked in there today, and you guys were all ordering the same beer at the bar at Roberta's.
Yeah.
What was that beer, and you know, what's the hype about it?
Well, that's the embarrassing thing.
Just to be clear, I was not ordering that beer.
This
is Greg.
Didn't order that.
You brought us what? The Vliet Pilsner from 3.
Vliet. It's not Vliet.
Excuse me.
Yeah, I mean, I even, you know, kind of made fun of Rarity, and then I show up and I order the rarest beer, even though I didn't necessarily feel like it. I show up and I want something lighter because I don't want to go on your show too wasted, Jimmy. And
Which beer was it?
It was Focal Banger from The Alchemist, an 8% IPA, and I, you know.
So I walked in, and it's fine that this was the theme of the show. I hadn't heard of it. I hadn't had it. But Chris, tell us, and at 3's, tell us, you know, you guys got some shipments of these cans.
Yep.
Very limited. Tell us the experience.
I was ecstatic.
But you have to order it? Were you were tagged as a place that could get it? Because when Alchemist sends cans to the city, there's only a certain amount.
Yeah, so there was a limited amount that they sent to the city, and you know, different accounts got you know, a shipment of beer. It was for on-premise consumption only. We kind of joked around at 3's that this could be kind of the harbinger of the end of, you know, IPA 16-ounce cans as a thing, you know, something that people kind of hoard and wait in line for. I don't think that's entirely true, but it is telling that, you know, a beer that people would drive, you know, hours and wait in line and chase trucks around as they made local deliveries up in Vermont, that they're starting to ship it to our market. You know, they're definitely getting to be a bigger brewery. They have more production capacity. So it's not as rare. I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, as an observer of beer, to see if that hype kind of stays with that beer because it's more readily available. And I think we're seeing the same thing in our local market, too. With Ironheart canning everyone's IPA, you know, 16-ounce cans of remarkably good IPA are readily accessible at nearly every single brewery. Yeah. You know, LIC, Finback, other half, obviously, you know, Interborough, you know, everyone in the game now is doing 16-ounce tall boys of IPA. So it's a thing.
Chris, tell us about, so at Grand Army Bar, you also got some of the Alchemist.
Yeah, I mean,
Focal Banger, that's
the Focal Banger.
I love that name, oh yeah. Focal Banger.
I have a good...
Can you deconstruct the name for us, Jimmy?
I have a pretty...
That's for the experts from beermenus.com.
I would say I have a pretty good relationship with the distributor that brought that in. So I got notice the day before it dropped, and received, you know, a couple of cases, and we're a cocktail bar. I try to maintain a really great but small beer program, but I didn't make a whole lot of fanfare about it. I, you know, put it on the menu immediately and encouraged all of our staff to sell it, you know.
But it made it to Roberta's, and like, you know, Aaron and Chris and Justin, when you guys came in, that's what you ordered today.
Yeah.
It was a surprise, but you almost can't say no to it. The surprising part, I know, was the rule for all you guys. You have to sell it on premise. Did it come as like a sticky note on the cases?
I wasn't told. I just assumed. But that's what I assume always. But, I mean, I think that rule is always so everybody can get a taste. And I really can't speak of how large the capacity is growing at The Alchemist in Vermont. But, I mean, going back to what Greg was saying, I think if, you know, New York City is receiving 600 cases of Focal Banger, Does that mean that this beer will be less desirable because it'll be in more markets? You know, it's like, I think we saw that happen with...
But do you like it, number one?
I like it. It's good.
I like it.
Shouldn't that be what's important, though?
It is.
Like, it's so...
It's a treat.
It makes my stomach turn that we're seriously considering the availability of something making it less good.
I mean, that's what we're talking about.
The effing liquid.
I mean, there's the Daisy Cutter from Half Acre out of Chicago. That's Half Acre increased their capacity quite a bit in the last couple of years, and so that beer is reaching a lot more markets than it used to. And I feel like it's lost a lot of desirability for people outside of the Chicago area now that it's easily available. I mean, I think if Three Floyds suddenly was distributing all over the country, nobody would. I mean, this is a brewery that people have been super cultish about for so many years. I feel like people would lose interest. They'd look somewhere else. They'd look for the rarer thing. And that's why we're here today to talk about this, I think.
And Aaron, was that part of the intention when you wrote that article?
You know, I think a lot of commenters thought I was saying, let's go back and just drink ESBs and lots of boring beers I can get at my local Key Foods. And I certainly wasn't saying that. I love Focal Banger, but I also love Vliet, which we can...
Vliet.
Vliet. Vliet, which we can get whenever we want.
All right. Hey, we're getting crazy. We're going to open a bunch of beers. We'll be back in a short minute on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
In 1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, guess what? Check us out. It's the end of your drive, heritageradionetwork.org. You can become a member. Big shout out. One of our regular guests is a new business member, Brooklyn Brew Shop. Steven and Erica, thanks so much. Brooklyn Brew Shop is a beer kit they ship around the world. It's a great gift for the holidays. So, you know, go ahead, be an individual member or a company member, but Heritage Radio Network. .org/donate. So we're talking about rare beers and, you know, how things have changed in 15 years. That's also part of it is like how people track it. There's so much more data. There's beer menus and all these other sites. But let's talk about the beers first. So, Greg, first we had the Threes Vliet beer.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Tell us what that beer is quickly.
Could I interrupt? I think you should just send the Alchemist a case of beer and say you can only sell it on premises of your beer.
That is a good idea. So this is Vliet Pils. It's one of the first beers we did at Threes. It's one of my favorite beers we do at Threes. It's kind of, I guess I would call it a hybrid Czech German style Pils. It probably is definitely more towards the German side. A little bit malty, a little bit hoppy. Brewed with Czech Saz and German Spalter Select hops. Kind of, for me, one of those great beers that sits between simplicity and complexity. And kind of can really suit many different contexts. You know, you can be sitting on the beach crushing it, not thinking anything about it and enjoying it. Or we can sit here and talk about, you know, how there's this nice kind of crackery maltiness to it and herbal hop character that are nicely in balance.
Greg, talk about how, you know, you're canning beers and getting beers out there. this is a beer that when you first had it on draft, people said, "Oh, it's unusual. It's the Vliet Pils, New York City Pils." But now, you know, what's the process of getting it in cans? Is it more readily available?
So it is. It's one of those beers that we really are making a concerted effort to have readily available all the time, both in package and in draft form. As we're looking to scale up our production, we'd like to make this kind of a cornerstone of our portfolio. It takes twice as long as everything else because it's a lager fermentation, which is a little bit slower. But it's I don't know, when you step back and look at kind of the development of a portfolio as a creative process, this is one of those beers that I feel very important about. You know, I think it speaks to both my vision of kind of the function of beer, that it's something that we can just sit around and enjoy and it's just good. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily scream for your attention. It can sit on the table with a good meal. And
it's great and it fits. But I'm going to take us back to when everyone's talking about collecting beers and the rare beers, it seems to be like, oh, you're going to have a can or a bottle. You're going to go wait in line to take it home. Hogwash, that's okay, but my life is different. Like in some of the great beer bars in New York City, we were getting just the specialty kegs from Threes, for example, and I would get a keg of Chronic Myopia IPA. That was one of my favorite beers of the summer. Well, thanks, I could, as far as I know, I could only get it in keg. Well, I want to bring it back to that. Like what happened to the things where only the special beers were going into kegs? And yet, like even here at Roberta's, Hill Farmstead was so rare, and I'm very happy that they regularly have Hill Farmstead Edward on draft. That's what I was drinking earlier.
Well, I think it's kind of funny. You know, most breweries start with draft beer because it's easier. You fill up a keg and send it on its way. It's a little bit more complex, especially to can. With the advent of mobile canning, it is more accessible to people. And, you know, as we said before, pretty much every local brewery is canning an IPA. It was kind of funny for us. We waited a little over a year before we started canning our beer. And the difference in public reaction from draft to packaged cans was pronounced. You know, we've been making Vliet Pils since the beginning. I think it was our fourth or fifth batch of beer we brewed at Threes. But it was only when we put it in cans that both people on the brewing side started reaching out to us to have them ship it to them. And also that people kind of talked about it as a real thing. You know, we kind of joke around that the beer doesn't exist unless it's in packaged form that people can kind of take with them. And it's, you know, especially in New York City, I think it's a little easier to view the drinking experience as going to a bar and having a bunch of beers with friends, taking the subway home and not thinking about it. But there is a large segment of at least the national population who needs to worry about driving places and consume a lot of beer in their homes. And one of the best ways to do that is with packaged beer.
Aaron, does this come into play when you're looking at the ratings of different beers over the years?
Well, I mean, once you package a beer, the geeks can trade it across the nation, and you get free distribution on that. So, you know, I live right by Threes. It's not just my local brewery. It's my local bar. I'm there every week. You can't tell someone in California Threes is the best brewery in Brooklyn, in my opinion, because they can't taste it. The second they can, I can send the stuff out there, and now it can become a national sensation. So, yeah. I mean, you see around the turn of the 2010s when Heady Topper starts getting canned, that's really the first time we start seeing hoppy beer getting sent around the country, whereas before these were tap-only things that most people weren't getting to try. They were trying maybe old bottled IPAs from Whole Foods that were good, you know, Sculpin's and 60 Minutes. But the second you could go buy Heady Toppers or Focal Bangers or, you know, canned beers, canned IPAs, and send them around the country, someone in California could drink his beer 7 days old at most, and he could start building a sensation in other places. So, yeah, it was definitely something that was crucial.
You know, Chris, you were talking earlier about that, whether this, you know, the rarefication, the cult collectibles, you know, do you feel like that the number of styles that people appreciate is limited?
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like there's much less variety in the market today, or what people are talking about today, than there was even 6 years ago. Which I think Aaron touched upon a bit in the article, being like, where did more boring styles like ESBs or Scotch ales or all that go? You know, like when Fuller's ESB once upon a time was largely respected, or even when I was working at Beercraft 5 years ago, and we would get a lot of people coming in for British beers that were kind of sleepy but wonderful. And now that's definitely fallen off. And
people
so,
barely even drink the great Belgian beers anymore.
I know. It's funny. It's like Duvel is wonderful. I feel like I just actually found, while we were talking earlier, my first Beer Advocate review from 2003, and it's of Duvel.
Of course.
That's and, but yeah, I think people, I think the conversation has gotten a bit narrower, of course. Well, you know, the beers that are traded online are largely IPA, wild ales of numerous stripes, mostly sour and wild yeast fermented ales and
imperial stouts.
And imperial stouts, because that's an enduring collectible. And I appreciate that an imperial stout is collectible, because it's a beer that you can lay down. And it seems a little problematic to me when IPA is becoming the collectible item, because IPA is the most perishable of American styles today. And
you're never gonna get an IPA from Threes to someone in Washington in the best shape. You know, I can go and pick it up out of his cooler. I know, right. It's been treated right. It's gonna get to Seattle, and God knows what weather it's been through. It's not the same beer. It almost defeats the purpose.
Yeah, I think what's particularly troubling for me, too, as the lens through which people are viewing the beer world through kind of narrows a bit, is, you know, it's so limited if you view the world through the lens of double IPA,
yeah,
or IPA. You know, we kind of joke around that, you know, Vliet is good for appeals, because we see people reviewing it like that all the time. And that's kind of a knock, right?
Oh, okay.
And it's like, oh, it's good for appeals, but that's, you know,
the highest pills at Beer Advocate probably gets like an 88.
Yeah.
Right? See, that's so troubling to me as somebody who appreciates Pilsner as a style of beer.
But it's like, it is kind of viewing the food world through like the lens of hamburgers.
Yeah.
It's like saying this, you know, this cassoulet is good for a hamburger. That doesn't make any sense. It just shows, I think, some maturation that has to happen in the beer world. That's all. Sorry, Jimmy.
So no, it's okay. I forget what I was going to say.
You're killing my flow.
We're talking about styles. Doppelbox, and then this beer that we brought in.
I brought in an early Grimm artisanal ales bottle from I think the fall of 2014, Scotch ale called Shapeshifter,
and it tastes great. It's refreshingly different.
Yeah,
style.
And it's very much in line with what they started doing originally. Now this brewery has become a huge cult success, but when they started, it was mostly kind of old school Belgian style beers. This one's kind of a hybrid Scotch ale Belgian double, I would say. I mean, it exploded when I just opened it, but which is telling. It's delicious. But Grimm has gone on to produce. As much as I love them and think they're excellent brewers, they produce a pretty narrow band of beers, and it's really to capture what the market is interested in. And what Grimm primarily does these days is hoppy beer, IPAs primarily, and sours. And those are the two styles that everyone is hungry for among kind of the beer cognoscenti or whatever. But it's also becoming a big thing, at least in our local bubble, of like what people are looking for.
I think what's interesting to me, though, is what's next, because, you know, we were talking about a little bit earlier, you know, Heady Topper was one of those first big hoppy beers that became kind of a thing. And I feel like the market kind of chased after that a little bit. And it still clearly is a thing. But at a certain point, something else is going to kind of accept that mantle. And what is that going to be? And I think that's what I find refreshing.
Yeah.
You know, if Aaron's kind of historical analysis awareness of things shows anything. It's that taste changes.
Yep.
You know, beer changes. It's this ecosystem that's living. And
one thing, so Gage from Beer, how do you guys track these trends? Like your number one beer, is it just by the beer, or do you track by style?
So, I mean, we've got data.
Do you know what the next, you know, popular beer is going to be from your data?
We don't have that much foresight into the future. We're not able to predict it. You know, IPA and sour and like Goza has had such a stranglehold on how we look at things for so long. I mean, all the top beers are IPAs. All the beers, you know, like the Grimms shoot up into the most searched for and most followed within days of announcement. It's, you know,
They also have a fairly regular Thursday, Friday release schedule where,
sure,
you know, unemployed geeks are running around the city
following the trucks.
Get a can.
I saw the general manager of the Double Windsor posted some Grim cans are on
Ryan
sale
Bedford.
Online for Ryan Bedford.
Big shout out Ryan Bedford.
Ryan Bedford. $45 for a pair of light year cans.
Yes. Is that true?
Yeah, $45 online for two, but.
You're gonna have to ask mom for bigger allowances.
Yeah,
but I tell you what, that's all great to know. We're gonna move on with this conversation. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Well, she's her own. She's her own female. She's her own female. That's why I like her. I like her a lot. And she don't know that she's her own female. She's her own female, and she don't know. That's why I like her a lot.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, it's December 2016. It's almost Christmas time, and we're talking with Aaron Goldfarb's article of going back in time. But again, 2001, you know, it's true. There, you mentioned other styles that people used to talk about. Celebrator Doppelbock.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, even Saisons, I noticed, you know, Greg, I'll put you on the spot. When you guys opened a couple years ago, you were originally going to be a Saison-focused brewery, but no one really talks about American Saisons anymore.
Well, you know, I think when we opened, it was always clear that we were going to brew a bunch of different styles. I think even then, you know, when we opened, we had three different Saisons on, two different hoppy beers, and Vliet Pils. Just having three Saisons kind of allowed people to say, oh, these guys are going to be a farmhouse-focused brewery, because it wasn't kind of a popular thing, and it was a little bit of an outlier. So because it was an outlier, that's how people kind of defined what we were. We still have two Saisons on to this day. Our portfolio really, you know, if anything, we maybe are brewing a little bit more hoppy beer and a little bit more pills just to kind of keep up with the demand. But at least with what we have at our bar currently, the portfolio is pretty much reflective of the day we opened.
The thing is, a lot of American quote-unquote Saisons nowadays aren't the funky Fantôme Saison DuPont Saisons. They're essentially just barrel-aged sours, you know,
yeah,
that the brewer's chosen to call a Saison. So, you know, he was making real Saisons that were funky and not barrel-aged, and they were delicious. But, you know, if you look at, like, Side Project, who I love, most of their Saisons, most of Corey King's Saisons are what you would call wild ales. So, you know, the Fantôme Saison, which I love, is kind of dead.
It seems like we've taken sort of a singular view to Saisons. It's, you're doing, a lot of brewers, and I exclude you, Greg, are doing either a DuPont clone or these crazy barrel-aged wild sours. But it's such a wide style, from adjuncts to base malts to yeasts and fermentation profiles. Most American brewers are only going to do just the straight DuPont yeast on a primarily wheat bill, or crazy, the extreme flavors,
right,
which of course bleeds into, you know, our bourbon barrel stouts and our super hoppy IPAs.
Chris, do you have any Saisons on the menu at Grand Army?
Yeah, I mean, the food program is centered on seafood and raw oysters, so, and I think Saison's perfect. So I do a blend. I mean, I've sold, and when I was doing beers at Myelin too, I thought the style was perfect for that food as well. I mean, Saison is like a very flexible style, of course, because it's a table beer. But yeah, I try to keep it local largely, and I do the beers from Transmitter, which I think are, their Saison's great and very nuanced, and definitely more in line with what happens in Belgium, where it's like a native yeast that they use every time and is sort of ornery and like unpredictable, but it defines the flavor, like Fantôme or like Blogie or like other classic Saison breweries in Belgium. You know, each one has a specific character. It's not been because it's a long utilized yeast. But very few American breweries have the restraint to do that and the time to kind of get that going. We were talking about Jester King earlier, and that's one of the few breweries they started using green glass at their breweries so they can get the flavor that you find in those kind of classic Belgian saisons of the kind of the light struck character.
I do think, you know, there's another layer to this conversation too about kind of restraint versus this kind of glaring, almost arrogant, you know, loud flavor profile.
Well, a lot of beer geeks will have a Saison or a wild ale and go, it was good, but it wasn't sour enough.
Yeah, totally.
It's not even supposed to be sour. It's
right, crazy. Yeah, of course.
I do wonder if that's just kind of another layer of this kind of maturation that maybe needs to go on in the beer world.
Yeah.
You know, I think about, you know, food a few years ago, and it was like everyone had pork belly on the menu.
Yeah.
And it was like,
it's very similar.
Just, you know, by virtue of it being pork belly was supposed to indicate somehow that this was a great food establishment. And then people realized, like, it's just a fatty piece of meat mm-hmm. that you actually need to cook properly. Otherwise, it's going to suck. And it's not good just because it's fatty.
Yeah. I remember opening up Fantôme bottles over the years, and like the ones that got the greatest response are the ones that were kind of infected and super sour.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, no, this is not like, I've only had, I think I've loved Fantôme Saison. I haven't had too many that were successful because their beers are so unpredictable, but
they're often majorly skunked by the time they get
right,
to America.
But it should, I think the flavor that I was always looking for was like a really beautiful, complex, kind of full-bodied Saison with the kind of strawberries in the background,
yep.
because
mm-hmm.
Danny supposedly always used strawberries, but like there's all these problems, you know, you'd find it like tastes like a rubber fire or,
sure.
you know.
I always thought that the good Fantôme was supposed to smell like petroleum.
Yeah.
See, that's
that's Saisons. Yeah. So Saisons have a way to go.
One of those things too. Delicate flavors are something that I, as a brewer and also a drinker, enjoy far more.
It's much more like wine. Wine is collectible, and I would love if we had time to touch on this, but like wine has been collectible since, you know, industrialization or longer, or
Thomas,
you know,
Jefferson.
Yeah,
least.
And like everybody loves like an 84 Magon or whatever, but like, you know, wine is a completely different type of beverage, and it's consumed in a completely different way. And those wines that are collectible for a reason. They're like prized vintages, and you know, it's, they're very expensive and all that, but when beers are so cheaply made, it's like, it's very intriguing to me that there's such a cult item. It's like, this is not like how beer, that doesn't fall into, you know, the history of beer consumption to me.
You know? I'm going to give a plug for the good, you know, good Brasil type small beer bars, because we see this stuff every day. We have a variety of different styles of beer, and a lot of Fridays I've been putting on a Franconian German, kind of very malty, almost bread-like, you know, these kind of amber lagers. And people go nuts for it. I think that there is an interest
That's refreshing, man.
There's an interest in different styles, but people want maltier beers, they want lagers. And I was wondering, for you, Gage, do you have a way of following that numbers-wise? You know, can you see a variety of styles that are out there, like on tap at beer bars around the country?
Yeah, so I mean, we've got we're able to track the trends, but it's IPA all the way. I hate to say it. I hate to bring everybody down, but it's we've been riding wave of IPA forever, and that's the top search, top followed. When you want to build a balanced program, which I know you guys run 12 lines, right? Very small but very well curated program. If we're talking about what does the drinker want most, it's IPA. They'd prefer eight lines of IPA, a sour, a barrel-aged beer, a Pilsner, because there's lots of people who will still drink it.
Because they brought a friend along.
They brought a friend. They bought someone who doesn't like beer. But it's IPA forever.
So Hillary, you're our NYU Food Studies grad student. If you had to go get a beer right now, do you actually have a brand in mind or a style of beer, or do you not drink beer?
It kind of depends what mood I'm in, but sometimes I feel like a sour, but lately I've actually been in the mood of stouts. They've been, especially if it's like more in the evening, they've just been like hit in the spot. So.
All right, so see, maybe your stats don't always work.
You know, it's what they're drinking. That's what they ask for. It's tough.
I guess to put Gage's stats a little bit differently, I think at our bar, and we've seen it, if we run out of IPA and we don't have an IPA on at any one given time, people will get visibly upset and not understand what our bartenders are saying.
I saw, while sitting at the bar at Roberta's, I saw two dudes just walk up and say, "Could I have an IPA?"
Yeah.
They were in a movie and just ordering a generic beer. They said, IPA.
That's almost synonymous with craft beer these days.
But there's some good ones, too.
Yeah, no, and you know, don't get me wrong. There is great IPA. I think the core of my argument is there's just more.
I mean, when I was at Beercraft, we did big growler sales, and on a busy weekend, sometimes we'd run out of IPA. When we had to tell people, it's like, oh, yeah, that pale ale's really hoppy. Like that. People were so angry. I'd never met such angry customers. But, the way I sell beer at Grand Army is, like, I stopped even, like, the most legible part of the menu is the style now.
Yeah.
Because I want people to come in and just be like, I want an IPA.
Well, it happens at Threes every single day.
Yeah.
We'll sit there, at the end of the shift and watch people order beer. And it's, can I have an IPA? Can I have an IPA? Yeah. Can I have an IPA? And that is the one style of beer. First of all, it outsells everything else 2-1.
Sure.
And it's the beer people will get upset if we don't have. We could, a lot of time, we brew a lot of light-colored beer at Threes. And we tend to serve a lot of light-colored beer because those are kind of the beers we like. There's been times where we haven't had any dark beer on for weeks. No one gets upset. But if there's no IPA, you better watch out.
Yeah.
It's tricky. It's top to bottom. it's not just the sought after the going to the Alchemist to get cans of Heady Topper or Trillium to get cans of whatever IPA it may be. It's everybody. It's the mildly educated beer drinker who says, I want IPA, to the people, to the trendsetters, right, for lack of a better word, who are going and waiting in line for all those beers. Just IPA. It almost doesn't matter.
Would you wait in line for a can of beer?
In my younger days.
We've all been there, unfortunately.
So what are places? No,
I have not.
I've never
waited
in line
for. Well, you can brew yourself a great beer.
Yeah. Yeah. Gage,
you're better than the
where
rest
have
of
you
us.
Waited for where have you waited in line for a
oh,
can of beer?
Oh man. Both coasts, up and down, across the country.
One brewery, pick one.
One brewery. Other half, I've done it. I have gone and waited in line. I just try to avoid it as often as possible, because you can go in the afternoon, maybe.
Yeah. I'm done. I'm officially done.
I try not to.
And what's one
at this point
that you remember waiting in line for?
What's one that I remember waiting in line for?
What ended it for you?
The last time I waited in line, because now, of course, I'm a famous beer writer, and brewers just give me their free beers. But I waited in line for the other half Trillium collaboration about 15 months ago. And it was awful. It was like a 5-hour wait, and the beer was fantastic. But I waited in line because I was visiting friends in New England. I wanted to bring up a case and be the big hero, and I did. And I brought up the case, and no one was thankful. And I said, "That's it.
That's brutal."
Yeah, no, that serves you right.
It does serve me right.
But I think this is. It's great that there is so much good beer around, so much good IPA around that. The line waiting phenomenon is hopefully waning. And
I mean, we should talk about how Three sells their IPAs, which I think are as good as anyone's. You just sign up online and buy some.
For us, we do have a full bar. We have the Meat Hook in there selling food. We have a coffee shop with Ninth Street Espresso up front. And we did our first release there, and people were lining up outside. And it really... became clear very quickly that it wasn't going to work.
I saw some dudes bought four cases of IPA. You don't need four 24 packs of IPA.
But beyond that, they, first of all, as we were, you know, we started the release at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We started rolling the pallets of beer in at 2:30, and people are giving us like dirty looks and being kind of hostile about getting out of the way. And then so what, they're kind of getting in the way of real customers.
What is this thing about? It might be another show about beer trading, because I've heard there's people with businesses that are trading beers. You know, there's guys, if you go to Belgium, you used to be able to have guys ship back, you know, your rare finds. And you know, would you guys know about beer trading?
Sure. Well, I mean, if you buy a case of Focal Banger, you can send it across the country to get a case of Monkish or Treehouse or whatever. So if you want to try every beer on planet Earth, you're going to have to start building up an arsenal of stuff in your neighborhood that you are worth trading. And that's in New York, other half, maybe threes, maybe some single cut stuff. Well, anything that's packaged. That was another thing packaging did. You know, people did trade growlers, but once you could put some lightweight 16-ounce cans and send them to Boston or Chicago or Iowa and swap them for stuff, that really built up the market.
Now, Aaron, if you could give a percentage of the amount of people waiting online at other half.
That are traders,
what would you say?
I honestly think it's like 95%.
Are you serious?
I think
that's what depresses me.
Really. Look, when you wait in line for a long time, you get to the front of the line and you're so pissed off. You buy as much as you can, and you buy the T-shirt and the Tiku, and you buy everything just because you're like, I didn't wait in line this long for a four pack.
Oh,
right. And then you get home and you realize, you know, if you're not a trader, holy crap, I have way too much 9% beer to ever finish. And 200 days later, you're going, I wonder if this is still all right.
Yeah.
So these dudes that are just dollying out IPAs are obviously traders. Of course, they're keeping a four pack, maybe, but you know,
maybe one can. I knew a guy, I saw him at Interborough after the other half Trillium collab that they did down here. He was in line at 11 p.m. the night before, third in line. Okay. He was not first at that time of night. Bought the limit, which was maybe a case.
Yeah.
And he said him and everybody else he was with had traded it all away before they got in the door in the morning.
Well, you also can, you know, put your wall of IPA up on Instagram for the sick likes.
Yeah, of course. You can stack as many as possible.
It must be a generational thing, because I have friends that do this with a custom sneakers. And it's the same exact
well, you know,
same.
Wait, this is if you walk through Park Slope and Gowanus on a Saturday, there's like 100 people waiting in 100 different lines, and it's for sneakers, it's for beer, it's for God knows what.
Multicultural
trading generation. Okay, last question for everybody.
You should make a sneaker.
Pick a beer. You should pick a beer. Okay, it can either be one of the rarefied that you'd love to have. What would you wait in line for? It could also be a classic beer. So start with Gage. What beer would you wait in line for, like, tomorrow, just so you could have a sip of it?
Oh, I want to say no beer. I want to say no beer is worth waiting in line for, but Jesse at Interborough's premiere, his first beer. I just did a piece for Brooklyn Magazine or a submission to say that was my best new beer of 2016.
It was
perfect. A premiere from Interborough.
Cool. Yeah.
I got it to have. It was phenomenal. It drank great. It held up for like the month that I had it.
It was good.
And I'm going to say it in as many places as possible. Jesse, make more, please.
All right. Greg, what beer would you wait in line for?
I don't know. No beer. I think, you know, for me,
there's got to be something, man.
No, I don't think there is, because there's so much good beer around. And, you know, the difference between the most sought after beer and one you can get these days is not worth waiting in line for. You know, maybe that's
that's the funny thing. People are trading juicy IPAs across the country for juicy IPAs that are like 1% different, 5% better. It's not much of a
but Aaron,
I think for me though, I'm the sort
which
of person though that's not going to wait in line at a restaurant.
You know what? I wouldn't wait in line, but I would wait in line for Eternal Return Chardonnay because it was one of the best beers this year, and people should wait in line for it. That's a three.
Chris, would you wait in line for any beer?
I would wait in line for that perfect bottle of Fantôme.
Fresh, not right scummed.
No, not fresh.
People used to wait in line for...
Give me a three-year-old, four-year-old bottle.
Guys, people used to wait in line for Cantillon, and that was something people used to track down, a good bottle of Cantillon.
That stuff's great.
My thing, a friend of mine shipped me the whole thing about shipping and trading, lives up in Vermont, sent me a care package of all those great kind of Vermont, you know, IPAs. And the one that actually stood out the most that I actually wish I could get now, it was Lawson's Sip of Sunshine.
All right. That's
and good. And that did stand out compared to other stuff I'm getting. But again, you know, the Nico's from Brooklyn Magazine is doing an article soon. Yeah, the best beers of 2016. So you picked yours. You know, we're looking at new breweries like Interborough and KCBC and Strong Rope and Industrial Arts and, you know, the Tears of the Heyday. There's so many great breweries now.
Sure.
Threes, you know. So I'm not waiting in line for any beer, but I'm kind of waiting in line. Become the Jimmy's number 43. You don't have to wait in line.
Yeah, no waiting in line.
No waiting in line.
All right. And, you know, we got one more live show this year. We're going to be going up to Notch Brewing around the new year and doing a live show up in Salem, Massachusetts. So talking about checking out other parts of the country. But it's been great having you guys on. Everybody just say your name and your affiliation. We're going to sign off.
It's Chris Bella from Grand Army Bar.
Aaron. Oh, Aaron Goldfarb, writer.
Hillary, NYU.
Greg Dorosky, Threes Brewing.
Gage Siegel, beermenus.com.
It was great meeting you guys and talking about all this fun stuff. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producer, Justin Kennedy. Thanks to our engineer, David Tatasciore. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Let me open this fucking dark room.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.